With the deadline for the Hippocrates Prize for Poetry and Medicine now closed, I've been joined again by organisers Professor Donald Singer from Warwick Medical School and Michael Hulse from the English and Comparative Studies Department at the University. So Donald, what's the next stage of the Hippocrates Prize now that the deadline for entries has closed?
We've now closed entries for the Hippocrates Prize, both for our NHS-related and open international categories. We're delighted again to have well over 1,000 entries from around the world from more than 20 countries. The two next steps are we shall be going on to the shortlisting by our three judges, Gwyneth Lewis, Welsh National Poet, Professor Steve Field, a leading GP, and the BBC's Mark Lawson. They will take a considered view of entries they think should be in the top three, both for the NHS and for the open international categories of the awards. That'll take place in early March with results announced in the week of the 7th. And then we shall go on to the 7th of May when we have our International Symposium on Poetry and Medicine, when the awards for the Hippocrates Prize will take place. And at that symposium, with the help of a panel of national and international speakers, we shall be drawing together four important strands linking poetry and medicine. That's to say, medicine as inspiration for the professional poet, poetry as therapy, poetry as another potential source of training for health professionals, both undergraduates and postgraduates, and importantly, poetry as a source of insight, as release, relief, catharsis for patients and their friends and families, as well as for health professionals. I'm delighted that we have with us today one of our symposium speakers, Professor Femi Oyebode from the University of Birmingham.
And Michael, just briefly explain why Femi's here and why he has agreed to join the symposium.
Well, I'm hoping that I can begin to get an answer to that myself right now, because I'm especially interested to hear from Femi, who's got a number of angles into this crossover. I'm interested to hear from him what possible applications there are for poetry in the discipline of psychiatry. And for that matter, and I'm going to say this in a slightly provocative way, for those out there who might be thinking to themselves, I don't really trust psychiatry anyway as a hard discipline, let alone poetry, isn't it even worse if we have these two rather clownish disciplines mixed? What can actually emerge from the interface that is of solid value to a patient?
I think the best way to approach it is to say that my primary interest has been in the use of the medical humanities in medicine as a whole. And of course, psychiatry is only just one of the subspecialties in medicine. And my first real interest was in seeing how we could use the medical humanities in teaching medical students. And the reason for doing that was very simple indeed. It seemed to me that there was a need to find a way to reintroduce a humanizing aspect to medicine, given the degree to which technological advance has invaded the clinical space. So the use of the medical humanities in my own particular context, talking about fiction, poetry, letters, diary entries and so on, was to find a way to get the students to recognize that the patients, that they are people, that they're human beings, and that they are not, the sum total of them isn't the disease they brought to the clinical space. So that was the real basis of it.
That sounds as if the application for you is in the training process.
Yes, primarily in the training process. So I use fiction, mostly fiction, some poetry, to teach medical students. I also run a column in the British Journal of Psychiatry, which is probably the second or third leading psychiatric journal in the world, and I run a column in it for poems by doctors, mostly published doctors, but I do get poems in there by doctors who have never been published before, who are only just starting out writing, in a serious sort of way. In addition to the poems by doctors, I also include as extras in the journal letters that if I find them interesting. So, for example, the suicide note by Virginia Woolf is a wonderful text to read. For psychiatry, of course, a very, very important text because it gives you a sense of the nature of hopelessness and despair. And even though we see patients who are in despair, because of Virginia Woolf's capacity to use language, her ability to be clear about how she's feeling is actually quite helpful for a training psychiatrist or indeed a practicing psychiatrist.
So developing that, it was fascinating at our initial International Symposium of Botanic Medicine last year, where the first Hippocrates Awards were made, that we had a number of presentations on that theme of how useful it could be to help trainee health professionals engage with their patients. And for example, we had Jiskin Day from Imperial College, and we had Dr. Foster from Gloucester presenting.
Jiskin Day discussed use of poetry to help medical students to engage more with patients. And Dr. Foster described how poetry could be used to help GP trainees in their work.
What was also fascinating first time around, and again in some of our many, well over 1,000 entries this time, there's a recurrent theme of a wide range of aspects of patient engagement with their illness through poetry. And picking just two strands, it's fascinating that historically that there are anecdotal stories of ancient Greek doctors using the poetry of theatre to help patients, people who are depressed going to the comedy, and people who are
too happy being sent to a tragedy.
Exactly. That, and in a more structured way, we had more, it's occupational therapy. Benjamin Franklin's first hospital in Philadelphia, they were using poetry of the patients.
They had the creative element and insight provided from writing poetry, as well as practical activities in running a printing press and then disseminating their published poems.
Mm. So can you comment what's considered amongst professionals the place of poetry on the patient side, on therapy side, nowadays in this country and beyond internationally?
Well, there is a kind of emerging field of, loosely speaking, called reading for well-being. It didn't start in hospitals or anything like that. It was just the idea that it's nice to read aloud together as a group. Started in Liverpool, and it's now become quite, I suppose it's emerging and developing all the time. So this is now coming to hospitals and coming to psychiatric hospitals as well. I'm not myself sure what this is about, because it's usually informal. It's usually done by volunteers rather than staff. And the patients and the volunteers decide together which books or which texts they would like to read and so on. And it does seem as if there's something about reading aloud to other people, and then something about discussing what they've read gives a greater depth of understanding of the material of the text that's been read. But they're not necessarily texts about illnesses or anything like that. My own take on it is that this business of reading for well-being is, it sounds terrible when I say it out aloud, that this is one of those things that's happening in Western society at the beginning of the 21st century, where people are fractured, where they're living as individuals, where there's very little sense of community. And these are just indirect mechanisms of bringing people back together. As you know, there's also the movement for singing together. So people who haven't sung go, meet once a week and sing together, and they enjoy doing it. And I think these are just activities. It's not the activity itself that's important. It's the fact that people are doing it together. So there's that aspect of things. But there's always been in psychiatry art therapy, and the idea that you can use the art as a kind of form of therapy for people. So allied to that, there's also always been this idea that people can write about how they feel. And you could say that that makes sense, because what people are doing is they're using the structure of writing to get control of their feelings. And you might say, some people would say, again, in quotation marks, the idea of narrative therapy, that the idea that if you are used to writing about your life in a particular mode, i.e. as a victim, for example, that retelling that story to somebody else who reads it, who then shows you that there may be other ways of thinking about your life, may give you a kind of sense of freedom and so on. So you could say that writing, not just reading, but writing can do the same, can serve a purpose for you. And in many respects, poetry is a bit like that, because it's short, it's a short form. For as long as they're not worrying too much about the quality of the writing, it allows people to get a bit of control, to get a bit of order. People talk about the ability to objectify your own experience so that you put it down on paper and then you read it as if it hadn't happened to you. And that gives you a little bit more detachment and so on, a bit more control over it. Diamond, who had cancer of the throat.
John Diamond.
Nigella Lawson's husband, who died from carcinoma of the throat, the writing about that was his way of getting a little bit of control in a situation where he felt as if he was a passive recipient of care. And we no longer, in medicine, we no longer allow people to have active participation, because actually, they're just a body, a passive body that's been given radiotherapy, if you see what I mean. So maybe writing, keeping a diary or a journal or something of that sort might give you a little bit of control, a sense that you are doing something, contributing and collaborating with the doctors to get yourself feel better.
And that leads into other examples from other areas, such as heart disease and cancer. I mean, Harold Pinter's poem about his own cancer, again, you might say rage or control. over his own illness. As a physician, the other interesting observation is, say, over the last 30, 40 years, what's been fascinating is how a lot of what were thought to be nasty diseases, not to be mentioned, like tuberculosis or cancer, through a lot of reasons, but including perhaps writings in poetry, have become rather demystified, and people treat them with perhaps less respect because they can see well-known or less well-known people who've written well, describing the illness in accessible ways.
You know, I'm a little bit worried about the idea that we no longer regard some things as awful, you know, that we no longer have proper understanding of the really important things, that we treat things contemptuously because we become so used to them. Do you see what I mean? So I've got a little bit of worry about that. Language becomes devalued. That's one of the reasons why I thought literature was important for students and trainees. It's almost as if they're indifferent to the condition of the patients they have. Therefore, when you help them to read a text about somebody who's dying from cancer and they saw the impact of that disease on the person, then it sharpened up the idea of the mortality of the individual and the fact that cancer is not a nice disease to have and that it's painful and that people have partners and children who are going to miss them.
I think there's a difference between losing respect or treating things too lightly and making things accessible. For example, tuberculosis used to be untreatable and then late 40s we have treatments and people were worried, perhaps weren't even seeking advice at the time. They're worried about this terrible disease. In reality, it is very treatable. And again, many cancers now, people live very well, long lives afterwards. Yeah. And I think having some awareness that these words can be used, whatever the route of access is, may help people not just come to terms with it, but be less shy of seeking advice in various ways.
Yes, I agree. You know, we should be able to say them. They shouldn't be unspeakable, but they shouldn't at the same time become so trivialised that they don't carry the weight that really should reside in them.
Femi, can I come in at a different angle to what you were just saying? One of the backlashes that's occurred in poetry over the period since the heyday of confessional poetry, since Sylvia Plath, whom you've mentioned, Robert Lowell, John Berryman,
and Sexton and all these people.
Others, in other words, who wrote tremendously forceful and memorable poetry out of their experience of clinical problems, depressive problems, a wide range of difficulties. One of the backlashes in the poetry community and the literary scholarship community has been precisely against poetry conceived as therapy, as an act of therapy. What you were saying just now, very understandably, put that experience of poetry in the foreground, the experience of poetry as therapy. And my question is this: would it make a difference to those who are confronting a major difficulty, for example, a terminal illness, if they were to express the feelings that they have as they confront this huge crisis in their lives from which there may be no return, not in poetry, but in prose? Why is it that poetry, in your opinion, seems to have this particular status in therapeutic terms as well for people in these situations?
I don't know exactly the answer to that question, but you are right. I mean, we can guess. I don't think we know the answer to it. I think there's something about poetry that it speaks directly, and sometimes, depending on what the kind of poem it is, it speaks not only just directly but concisely about an issue. But it has a way of doing it which, you know, so you've got all the rhythm and the musicality of the words, which makes it, more amenable to the spirit than reading a long prose text.
You've spoken of acquiring the sense of control. Do you think it's something to do with being able to govern that music? And in the act of governance, of creating sounds which seem to mean more, there is also with it the illusion that one has got the greater control. Is that it?
You know, why is it so warming to the human spirit, even when it has a bleak content? Do you see what I mean?
And that's a paradox, isn't it? Yeah. Yes.
And then you do have that. You can get the same feeling if you read prose which has rhythm in it. So if you read prose which has a speech inflection in it, you can get the same feeling that you are in the company of somebody who can carry you along. But I think poetry does it very, very nicely because it's got the rhythm, it's got the beauty of the sound of the words, the musicality of the words themselves. But people go onto the internet to go and download these poems, to read them or to send them. So there must be something in them that they're that suits them, that is, you know, they're finding helpful and mm. giving them some degree of relief and so on.
Mm. I do have another question that I'd love to hear your view on as well. And this is unrelated to what we just spoke of, but it's a very ancient idea, at least as old as the Greeks, that poetry and insanity are closely related. And for the English speaker, Dryden put that at its best, and great wits to madness sure are near allied, and thin partitions do their bounds divide. Do you see any affinity from your practice in that sense of being presumably, let's put it differently, not insane, but displaced, of being, as it were, at a different angle to what others around you consider normal or real? Is there an affinity between the ways that people considered by society not to be in their right wits think? Is there an affinity between that and the ways that poets metaphorically read the world?
I have to answer that question indirectly, and then I'll come to try and approach it properly. So I think we know that creativity is allied to mental illness. So we know that individuals, and work's been done on this, so we know that individuals who have a diagnosis of mental illness are much more likely to be creative than a comparative group. We know that their first degree relatives are also much, who don't have mental illness, are much more likely to be creative compared to the first degree relatives of people who are not mentally ill. Very important piece of work needs to be done over the next 20 years or so, because as we approach looking at the genetic basis of manic depression, of depressive episodes and schizophrenia and so on, and once we know what the genetic basis of them are and we better understand all that, the likelihood of people being aborted is going to increase. Yet we have some sort of understanding that these conditions, which we're not recommending for anybody to have because they're pretty devastating conditions, we have some sort of clue that they seem to be allied to creativity, not just to literary creativity, to music and you know, to painting and so on. So there is there, and maybe that's what the Greeks and the others have been hinting at. If you then start to ask the question, what is it about these conditions that we could say hints at extra creative sensibility? And some of the things are, when you are manic, you get very, very rapid rush of ideas. And some of these ideas are off-beam. They're the ideas that people would not normally stay with. Whereas, because you're ill, these ideas, you're just charged with them. And if you're lucky, and you can hang on to some of these ideas, you can then use them as inspiration when you recover. You've got tremendous energy for work, amazing energy for work. You've got this amazing perception of the world, so the colours look different. So a bit like taking mescaline, and that's like a natural kind of understanding of the world. So you see things, they stand out in a way they've never stood out for you before. Mm. And again, if you're lucky, not everybody can do it, if you're lucky, you can then borrow some of that and use it as inspiration in the writing or in the painting and so. And if you're depressed, you also see the bleakness of the world for what it really, really is. And if you, again, you're lucky, because whilst you're in the depressive phase, you haven't got the energy or the drive or motivation to do any of this work. But if you can get some of that into your memory banks, then you can use it when you come out of that. And then if you think of schizophrenia, the beauty of schizophrenia is this capacity to see the world, to think in a very, very strange and bizarre way indeed, to use metaphor without realizing that it's metaphor. So to use concrete images as if they were real. So an example might be somebody who's walking sideways along a corridor, and somebody says to him, you know, why are you walking sideways along the corridor? He says, because of the side effects of the medication. The normal person wouldn't have that capacity to just see that link and or to even to say it. So you've got that sort of wonderful use of language, this concretization, I think, of images, that is very, very important in poetry, especially in very, very good poets, that they can see an idea and they can go with it. And these people are doing it spontaneously all the time. Obviously, they're not well enough to write great poetry or great novels, because they haven't got the concentration for it, they haven't got the drive for it, they can't develop an idea, the sustained idea over a long period of time and so on. But you can see that their first degree relatives, if they've got the same brain systems, that they're able to tap into these things and they're not ill, and therefore they're able to use it.
That raises a fascinating question about reasons why this might happen. And you've described various types of psychiatric disorders with a link to strange ideas expressed. What's fascinating also is there's now lot of interest for new biological treatments is that some of the inflammatory mediators generated by infections can affect the brain. And it might be the kind of treatment you could use, say, to suppress rheumatoid disease. Okay. You might be able to suppress various types of illness like depression.
That's right.
It raises a further question. We know that, for example, Keats died of tuberculosis.
As did Chopin. And also in the field of music, Schubert suffered from syphilis.
It raises the question, people who are predisposed, is there something around the stimulation by these consequences of disease which might be
making those with the potential to be creative
able to do more? Or might it be as simple as you say, that they're driven, that they know their days are numbered, and therefore they see the need to be as productive as possible?
I mean, we don't know, do we? I mean, that's the truth, really. The days of thinking of these serious illnesses as if they were diseases of the mind, they're gone. So we know that manic depression, depressive episodes, they are physical illnesses, and actually the mood change is only a tiny little bit of the conditions, because these people have, as you've already said, increased cortisol levels, they have propensity to obesity, propensity to diabetes, propensity to hypertension, propensity to cancers, and they die younger than everybody else, and not from suicide. You know, so there's no doubt at all that their whole system diseases, which only happen to be presenting to somebody called a psychiatrist who is a doctor of the mind. Actually, they're physical illnesses in the full sense of what a physical illness is. And they probably do have brain changes that go beyond just the mood aspects of them.
This is extraordinarily interesting territory. There is another thing that I want to ask you about, Fermi, because you've been producing this doctor's poetry column in the British Journal of Psychiatry for quite a while. Do you have a particular take on that phenomenon? Because I come from the literary side, so I think William Carlos Williams, I think Gottfried Benn, in a different discipline, I think Chekhov. Many writers come to mind who were doctors. You're seeing something different. You're seeing it in the context of a psychiatric journal. What is your view of doctors who write, and what they're producing there, and how it relates to their main practice in their lives?
I'm never sure why doctors write. And you've mentioned quite a number of them, so William Carlos Williams and Anton Chekhov. So it's a little bit difficult to know why they write. But some of the skills that you require for good writing are part of the same skills you require for being a good doctor. So if you think of being a good writer, whether you're a poet or a novelist, you need to have the capacity to observe very carefully how people are. And so if you think of Conan Doyle, for example, and Sherlock Holmes, it's all about observing the person as they come in. And you can tell without them telling you that they smoke, or they work in a colliery, or something of that sort, or they just come back from abroad or something like that. And of course, the whole of medicine, you know, in my day was a bit like that, that the idea that you can just see, you know, somebody's gait and you can tell whether they've got syphilis or they've got something wrong with their cerebellum or something like that. So that ability to observe very carefully is part of medicine. And if you then think of something like psychiatry, where it's not just observing the physical habitus or the gait of the person, but actually observing whether they are, whether they speak in a whisper, whether their voice goes tremulous over a particular subject, whether they lean towards their husband, whether they're playing with their wedding ring or not, whether they shift in their seat when they're talking about a particular object or whether a subject, or whether they look away from you, and so on. So you are doing exactly what the novelists do. You're observing human beings and inferring emotional life on the basis of those observations. So I think we've got this training. If we had the gift for writing, we've got the training for observation. But I think the reason for writing may be exactly the same reason that people who have serious illness write. Some of it is just to if you wish, to handle the material. Because, you know, there's this new term that people use, that you can have compassion fatigue. And so there's this, you know, these relentless numbers of people who turn up to be seen, who expose to you your own vulnerability. And therefore, you're full of dread, of anxiety about whether you yourself will have these diseases and how might you cope and so on. So some of the writing, I think, comes out of that, this wish and desire to control a world which you know, because of your training and trade, that is not controllable so much.
The other obvious elements are you would hope that doctors are interested in humanity.
That's right.
And in all its perspectives. Mm. And in the course of their lifetime, through that interest, would be exposed to a huge range of all human life, history
of people, stories.
People from around the world, stories. For people from all ages, all perspectives, all walks of life, which again provides tremendous inspiration for potential writers.
Well, we've been talking today with Professor Femi Oyebode, who will be one of our speakers at the symposium, the International Symposium on Poetry and Medicine at Warwick University on the 7th of May, and the Hippocrates Prize will be awarded at that symposium.